You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Let me just compliment you, Bill. Your background image is great. You are obviously, you've purchased an office downtown, and things are going really, really well.
This is my moving on up to the east side.
Arguably the greatest TV show theme in history.
And you seem to have found a new location as well.
Well, let me just say before we go to that, isn't it interesting that Sherman Hemsley, the late great Sherman Hemsley, two of the best theme songs ever, right? Don't Sleep on the Amen theme song. That's a good one.
I thought you were gonna say All in the Family.
Well, okay, he was Sherman Hemsley wasn't even the only Mr. Jefferson on that show, was he? Wasn't there another George Jefferson before him?
Or am I mistaken? I think so. I forgive me if I'm misremembering, but Lionel was on the show first.
Yeah.
Before George came in, and you can still find the episode on YouTube. One of the greatest episodes is when the Jeffersons move next door, and there's a scene where Archie is talking to his white neighbor who's moving out, and Archie is fondly reminiscing when they all banded together to keep the Jews out of the neighborhood, and how his neighbor like got the petition to keep them out, and Archie's like, you know, these people, they aren't Jews, are they? And he's like, oh no, they're Baptists.
Okay, so let's say Sherman Hemsley was part of three. Not one, not two, but three of the greatest theme songs of all time.
I could not even tell you the Amen theme song.
Well, I mean, Amen was not quite up to the level of the Jeffersons or All in the Family, and then the pantheon of 70s and 80s TV shows, but it's quite good. It's like a chorus singing a gospel song. It's really good. Bill, you mentioned my background. Yes, I have decided to become an artist. and so this is my studio behind me. It's pretty cool. We've both stepped up our game, obviously. Especially you. I mean, you were like in a basement at one point. Now you're in a loft. So
I'm definitely not in my mother's basement right now. I am most definitely in a fancy loft.
It's like certainly a corner office, obviously.
Those listening on the podcast have no idea what we're talking about right now.
The audio podcast will be missing the beautiful background. But why wouldn't you want to watch us as handsome as we are, and now with greatly improved backgrounds?
But perhaps we should talk about non-visual topics.
I thought this would just be about Skype and you know, audio and video settings, but okay.
And TV theme songs. So I'm happy to do a full episode just on TV theme songs someday. But perhaps
All right. Well, you know, let me just get you started, because I think the greatest American hero has to be in the conversation. I think the Fall Guy has to be in the conversation. I think the Dukes of Hazzard has to be in the conversation. So that'll get us started. What do you think?
I'm with you on Greatest American Hero. I used to sing that to my children when I was changing their diapers.
Believe it or not, yeah. George isn't at home.
Look at what happened to me. I can't believe it myself.
George Costanza had that answering.
Yes, that was a great episode. Good Times. You got Good Times in there.
Good Times was a really good one. That's right. I like that one a lot.
Instrumental, but Night Court. Night Court is our instrumental theme fine. Songs go.
Cheers has to be on the list, right? Cheers,
Facts of Life.
And by the way, we didn't mention Family Ties, which I think is just an okay theme song. But do you remember when Alex danced to a song? What would it take? I'm trying to think of the name.
Yeah, at this moment.
At this moment.
Billy Vera and the Beaters.
And it became like a hit.
That was a big hit, right? Yeah.
The show made the song, right?
That did. It's a good song on its own. Yeah. One of my karaoke staples is the Love Boat theme. That's a classic.
I'm going to say that's a little too cheesy. Like, it works for purely nostalgic reasons, but I don't think it stands on its own.
I disagree completely. Wonder Woman, also another perfect song.
Linda Carter,
yeah.
Getting it done. Marylander, as I recall.
Anyway, we could go all day, but there is an election to pick through. There is the fabric of democracy hanging by a thread to discuss.
No, I think this is what the post-election DMC is. Like, we've done the election. That's over. This is the brave new DMZ. This is how we keep from fighting. That's how it stays the DMZ. We just post, you know, we filibuster and we avoid talking about politics.
I want to ask you, Matt. Is it possible for the Republican Party to quit Trump?
Well, it's funny you should ask that question, Bill. I'm writing my column about it right now.
We didn't even pregame that.
Well, I think that what they should do is to quit him because he's not going to leave, right? There's this calculation that placate him, co-opt his supporters, and eventually he'll go away. Well, that's just a flawed assumption. Like, he's never going away.
Now, just to be devil's advocate here, now I did a shareable YouTube last night where I suggested that they should quit Trump and argued why. But to be devil's advocate, he has a big base of support. He didn't lose that badly. And he is hard to get away. If he's going to run, he's going to run. Why not just lean into it and use him to the best of your ability to keep that Republican base motivated, thwart Biden at every turn, make it hard for him to get anything done, and reap the benefits in 2 years and 4 years? Just put aside your own dislike of Trump. Is there anything factually wrong with that argument?
Well, I think it's flawed if you're anybody who wants to run in 2024.
Well, that is certainly true.
Okay, so that's if you want to win in 2024, then you need to get rid of Trump. And I also think that if you want the party to move on and to grow and to learn, and actually, I don't think the party should reject everything about Trump. I think it's going to be like a hybrid. We see Marco Rubio and Axios talking about, kind of winning over working class Hispanics, for example. I think that's kind of the model, right? It would be a hybrid approach. But you can't have the new leaders emerge if Trump is overshadowing everything.
So you got a lot of people that would like to run in 2024. Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, Marco Rubio, Josh Hawley. I'm sure I'm missing some folks. I think Chris Christie seems to hasn't lost the bug. I'm sure there's others out there that I'm not. DeSantis, Florida, Rick Scott, Tim Scott. Do they have to work together? Do they need to lock arms somehow and say, hey, guy, thank you for your service, but your service is no longer needed here? But are there too many of them that just feel like they can't do that because if to insult Trump is to sabotage their own chances in 2024? It seems like the only way you could do it is we all have to lock arms. They can't get rid of all of us.
Yeah, it's the collective action problem. It's so funny how much of this parallels 2016, right? In 2016, there was the sense that Trump was going to flame out and go away on his own. So instead of being the one who pushed him out, suck up to him and then inherit his followers, that didn't work. And there was also that tragedy of the commons sort of problem. And I think it's the same thing today. But don't they learn their lesson? Like, you're not going to inherit his followers. He's not going to go away. And so they should join up because it is in everybody's collective interest for Trump to go away. As long as Trump stays around, and he has every incentive to do so, he is going to overshadow everybody else. He's going to freeze the field. He's going to humiliate other Republicans and degrade them. And he's going to prevent them from taking the steps that you would normally take having lost a presidential election to try to heal and move on.
Now, that makes sense for those who want to run for president, but they are a very small minority of all the elected officials in the Republican Party, let alone the rank and file Republican voters. How willing do you think the average elected Republican official in Washington, does the average Republican elected official like the notion of being in the cocoon of Trump's party with their benevolent Republican father, Donald Trump, leading the show for 4 years, 8 years, until he dies, until he can pass the baton to his son?
Kayleigh McEnany on Fox, it was either Fox News or Fox Business, but just said he will be the titular head of the GOP for generations.
Do you think the average elected Republican official is comforted by that? Or they say, I can't be in a Trump-led party for one more hot second before I want to, you know, suffocate myself, and I need to do something to prevent that from happening?
I mean, I think it's divided. I think that there are plenty of Republicans and elected Republicans who love Trump and Trumpism, and they don't have ambitions of becoming president, and they're perfectly happy with it. And then I think there are a lot of Republicans who just hate this. They hate the chaos. They hate what Trump is doing, but they realize that Trump is popular with their voters. And so they're sort of held hostage by him. They have to play these games. So I think it's sort of divided, Bill.
And how much of it...
By the way, we should talk about this too. This, you know, you hinted at it earlier when I was talking about TV show themes, but you know, there are a lot of regular voters out there who not only are comfortable with Trump, but they think he has won re-election, and they think this election is being stolen from him. And so, look, if Trump had lost in their eyes, clearly, then maybe they would move on. But the fact that he is, you know, casting this as having been stolen from him, is just another reason why that they might stick with him.
Do you think that, I mean, obviously there are people who are just hardcore Trump to the bone and will just follow him to the ends of the earth. Is it fair to characterize all 71 million plus voters of Trump in that camp? And how many of those could potentially be convinced, okay, this wasn't stolen. I'm a Republican because I like low taxes and conservative judges, not because I like this joker. And after a few months removed from the election, I'm ready to turn the page.
It's not fair to say, to paint with a with a broad brush there. I think that there are a lot of people who love Trump and are uniquely, you know, sort of Trump supporters. And then I think there are just other rank and file Republicans who went along with them. So I think that there are some people who would like to move on and some people who, you know, so it's divided. But I think that the Trump supporters are the diehard Trump supporters, the people who like prefer Trump over other Republicans, not just as a binary choice better than Hillary or Biden, but they love Trump. I mean, they tend to be very loud and proud, and they're a sizable chunk. So they cannot be ignored, that's for sure.
To what extent does Biden's performance going to affect this? I was talking about this, you know, last night on the YouTubes. They in the mid 19th century, it was widely understood that Democratic Party strength relied on a strong Whig party to be a foil. We need to keep all our disparate elements together to stop the Whigs. And the Whigs, by the same token, said we need a strong Democratic Party as our foil to keep our internal divisions tied together. I mean, we talk about how there's more positive votes for Trump and less positive votes for Biden because the Democratic Party's disparate elements were unified to stop Trump. But to what extent is the Republican unity contingent on not looking at Biden as a lovable moderate, but pointing out, oh, there's all these evil socialists lurking behind him, and we need to band together to stop that. And if Trump's the force that's required to stop evil socialism, then let's all just get behind him. If that's the case, if Biden's performance in office continues in the common sense slash moderate vein, does it become harder for Trump to maintain a level of unity in the party? And does it become easier for folks who want to break away and even like work with Biden on something? Can they actually have the oxygen to do that if the Democrats seem less scary?
I mean, I think it's really hard for anyone to pull that off. Like Joe Biden, I mean, I'll give you an example. Like Joe Biden has already said, there's just two things that come to mind that Biden has said he wants to do that probably strike you as not a big deal. But I think they're like the culture war type issues that that will be very important. One of them is remember Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, changed Title IX, I think it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This has to do with if someone on a college campus claims sexual harassment, the burden of proof and things such as that. She changed that. Biden's going to probably change it back if he can. And then the other, I'm trying to think of the other one that jumps to mind.
Well, you mentioned climate and race in your last column.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Race is the other one. Sort of. It's Biden is going to have an executive order that reverses a Trump order. Trump got rid of these diversity trainings that you have to go to, like in corporate jobs or bureaucracies.
But this is for the federal government.
Well, it was for the federal government, and I think it also was in the private sector.
Well, maybe contractors. I mean, there's no way by executive order you can force a private business to have a diversity training.
Yeah, but if, like you say, I mean, if they want to do business with the government or something, I don't know the details, but this was, I mean, at least the allegation was that it was like preaching critical race theory or things like that. So, I mean, these are two issues that Joe Biden has said he wants to reverse very quickly, if not on day one. And these are cultural, you know, hot button issues that I think, you know, no matter how moderate or centrist we think Joe Biden is, I mean, those two issues alone are going to give a lot of fodder to Fox News and talk radio, right?
Well, it is, you know, a very tricky balance for Biden because he's not going to be able to get a lot done legislatively, it looks like. I mean, even if Democrats pull off the two Georgia runoff elections, that gets you to 50-50. It becomes it's not even a given, I think, that makes Schumer the majority leader. They have to work on some sort of power sharing agreement, even though Kamala is the tiebreaker vote in that circumstance. And then getting you're not going to get nuclear option in that circumstance because Manchin and Sinema have already said they would never get rid of the filibuster. Getting 10 Republicans for anything is not going to be so simple. So your legislative options are still pretty narrow. You might be able to get something done through budget reconciliation, but that requires perfect Democratic unity, and that's not so simple either. So the pressure to do things that are more progressive are going to be in the executive order realm. Now, I don't think Biden's going to go off half-cocked, and probably because he's probably pretty aware that a lot of executive orders could get struck down by the courts, and he probably doesn't want to have those battles nonstop. But surely he'll do something. He'll do something that's on the progressive side of things that folks at Fox and, or maybe, right. maybe not Fox, now that Fox is in on it. You know, Fox is part of the conspiracy. But Newsmax and OAN and RT, you know, they might call things out.
This is a real thing, by the way. I just want to stress. I mean, I'm more in touch now than I used to be with the Trump voter. And I can tell you, like, I don't know if it's going to, I doubt if it's going to affect Fox's bottom line anytime soon. I doubt if it's going to affect the ratings. But I can tell you this whole notion about Fox being in, you know, liberal and Newsmax and OAN being better, it's gotten around. This word has spread. This is, you know.
I mean, Fox had the temerity to call the election.
Yeah. How dare they?
So, you know, Biden is very interesting in that, you know, if you might recall, Matt, I did a piece during the 2016 campaign about the Bastion of Deplorables comment and how that fit in with the Democratic Party's approach to race and presidential elections going all the way back to George McGovern. And, you know, Democrats had long had a wink and a nod to the racial grievances of the white working class, including Bill Clinton, including Barack Obama, up until Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's the first one to basically call out racism very bluntly and not give any kind of tolerance or rationalization of it. And Biden is closer to Hillary than he is to Bill and Obama in that respect. You know, Biden had a little bit more, or I should say a considerable amount more of open bonding with the white working class. You know, I'm the boy from Scranton, that kind of stuff. But he hardly watered down Black Lives Matter and systemic racism and that kind of talk. So he's walking a very fine line on these cultural wedge issues, successfully in terms of the election is concerned. You know, he wins the trade-off between winning college-educated suburbanites and retaining the lion's share of Black and Hispanic votes, even though he sacrifices a little bit of Black and Hispanic vote on, you know, non-race grounds, and loses the, still the majority of the white working class on those grounds. So there's the opening for those kinds of attacks on the right to try to paint Biden as a member of the secular cultural left. And the challenge for Biden is to leaven it in the way they leavened it in the election.
Yeah, which is probably harder to do while governing. Yeah. I mean, Joe Biden got to run for election with a friendly press and during the pandemic, which I think allowed him to really control his message much more than a normal candidate would, including the conventions, right, where you didn't have, you know, Bernie Sanders and AOC giving speeches and stuff like that, or at least not droning on into the late hours without being checked. And so Biden was able to really have a lot of message discipline and really walk the line, strike that perfect balance during the campaign. It's going to be harder to do, presumably, as president. I do think that Biden does have just a lot of he's just temperamentally very, very good at coming across as a kind of regular guy who's appeal who has an appeal to working class.
You know, Andrew Yang had a comment that, you know, Joe Biden's magic powers and everything he says becomes reasonable. And, you know, Yang was saying that, and other columnist in the New York Times, I forget to pronounce his name properly, who's very much on the left. They were sort of using that as a way to suggest, hey, Biden, embrace our radical leftist ideas, because when you say them, they sound reasonable.
Right.
But of course, Biden has that power because he knows not to embrace yeah. those ideas.
It's like the guy in The Godfather. There's a line. Remember, they want Vito Corleone to sell drugs and to use. They want him to do it because he has got all the police in his back pocket, mm-hmm. you know. And Vito says something like, all of these friends that I have might not be so friendly if they thought I was involved in something unseemly, like the narcotics trade, you know. And it's like the same sort of thing. Like, does Biden sound moderate because he, you know, can make anything sound moderate, or is it because he tends to only champion moderate stuff? It's a chicken or egg, I guess, type thing.
But I think the one hope he has at creating some kind of division amongst Republicans and breaking off a chunk who will work with him on things is maintaining that place of reasonableness, of being the voice of common sense. So you look bad if you're not working with him. And there are Republicans in states that, I mean, look, you have almost no cross-pollination in the Senate right now. Almost every Republican's in a red state, almost every Democrat's in a blue state. I mean, I think you're Collins in Maine. You got Johnson in Wisconsin. And you have Toomey in Pennsylvania, and Toomey is 1 foot out the door. I don't think we have any other Republicans. Well, again, we'll see what happens in Georgia. We're now Arizona that flipped out is going to have two Democratic senators. And North Carolina stayed red, so they still have two Republican senators. Iowa still has two Republican senators, and that place stayed red. So I think it's just those three. And so we'll see what happens in Georgia. But if you are in a Republican in a light blue state or Republican in a light red state, I think you have to at least worry about seeming unreasonable in the face of Biden's reasonableness, assuming Biden can keep that mantle. Ron Johnson probably will never crack, but that puts him potentially in a vulnerable place in 2022.
And Bill, I think that's part of the reason why this runoff is such an unfortunate event, because you could imagine a scenario where McConnell might see it in his best interest to in the best interest of his Senate, midterm Senate class to work with Biden a little bit and get some things done. But McConnell has to stay majority leader. He has to win one of those two Georgia seats. And to do that, he has to keep Trump's base riled up, right? And so,
at least between now and January 5th.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's 2 months during which time Donald Trump is like embroiling the nation in this, contested election controversy. So, I mean, it's a pretty important time. It's not forever, but it would be nice if Republicans could start to move away from Trump. But I think this runoff election is one more like thing Republicans, one more obstacle that keeps them from moving away from Trump.
Now, we talked many, many times whether Republicans should have passed another COVID-related stimulus bill or relief bill before the election so Trump could brag about putting checks in your pocket. Now, is there any reason why McConnell would try to shepherd something through so Perdue and Loeffler could vote for it and say, hey, look, we're still doing your business. We're taking care of you. Or are they, if they don't do it, does that give Ossoff and Warnock saying, hey, these guys won't come through and gridlock's going to remain unless you get these folks out of here?
That's a really interesting question. Are the Democrats saying that now? They probably, I guess they are afraid to make that the defining issue in case it.
Yeah, I mean, I had some people on my feed say they show a stimulus, and I said, well, what if they pass stimulus? And
that's what I'm saying. Like,
it's not going to work.
What if they basically, answer their call and do it, right?
Yeah, so I haven't seen Warnock and Ossoff lean on that yet. I did see Ossoff say, essentially vote for us or it's going to be gridlock for 4 years. I think that is, I mean, the challenge for the Democrats there, because it's not intuitive to the average voter. The average voter might think, oh, if I vote for the Republican, then I'll ensure bipartisan governance. So that's a safe vote to make. If I vote for the Democrat, maybe AOC gets to run the show. And the Democrats' job is to say, what you don't want is gridlock. We want to get things done, and I want to work with the more moderate Biden to get common sense things done. Don't worry, I'm not going to do AOC's bidding. I'm going to work with Biden. I'm going to work with Republicans, and we're going to come together. But we can't have a situation where it's just everything's going to be DOA. So that's it. Takes more steps to make that argument.
But well, I think especially because we just came out of an election where the voters seem to have at least subconsciously voted for divided government and for gridlock. And so if you're a Democrat, you're not only are you selling a more complicated theory, but it's one that the voters generally just rejected.
I mean, I think the Senate candidates' performance largely tracked presidential performance. You did not see wide variations. So there's some ticket splitting going on, but it's pretty minimal. And the only state where the Senate winner was different than the presidential winner was Maine, where you had someone who was a longtime incumbent with a bipartisan reputation, if undeserved to many people in the view of maybe on the Democratic side. So there's just – and now you have a situation in Georgia where everyone's going to know this determines control of the Senate. There's no way to make it a local race. It is a nationalized race by definition. So you better make voters comfortable about the idea of a democratically held Senate or else the Democrats are not going to win. You got to find a way to make that case or it's not going to happen.
Well, they may be better off, I guess, you know – If there isn't a stimulus saying when Joe Biden, you know,
oh, definitely.
If Joe Biden gets in, you need us to pass that. Right. So that's the answer.
Excuse me. Thank you. But there's no way. I mean, Democrats have not been Machiavellian about this sort of thing. I don't think you're going to see Schumer filibuster a relief package. I don't think you're going to see Pelosi block a relief passage because it wouldn't work. I mean, it's one thing to say Republicans failed to give you a stimulus vote for me. It's another to say Democrats blocked the stimulus vote for me. That doesn't have to say, that doesn't gel.
Do you think Republicans are going to, I mean, the problem with Republicans doing this is now that Trump is apparently going to leave, well, not leave, but leave the White House, presumably, they're going to return to their fiscal conservative roots. And so the Ted Cruz's and the Rand Paul's are going to probably not want to spend more money, right? And so would they do that just to help save the Senate for Republicans?
I don't think a Cruz would. I would think if McConnell put something on the floor and it has Trump support, and these are two big ifs, you would get enough Republicans.
Because all the Democrats would support.
I mean, that's not quite a given because, you know, McConnell wants to go cheap. He doesn't want to do anything nearly as big as what Pelosi is asking for. So you wouldn't get unanimous Democratic support, probably. But I imagine you would get some saying some is better than nothing. That could make its way through. Now, you know, Pelosi's a tough negotiator, so maybe she would say this is too small and I'm going to wait until Biden's in and try again. There's a lot of moving pieces here. And people's spin, people's characterization of, is something better than nothing, or is this fundamentally insufficient? You know, whoever wins that argument might depend on how many votes each side gets. But it's hardly the case that when Biden gets in, it's going to be somehow easy to pass a stimulus bill. So there is an argument for taking what you can get when it's in front of you.
Interesting. Like I said, I'm working on this piece, and Republicans are just in this really bad catch-22 type situation. I mean, they can't move on without Trump. They can't heal without Trump. The next generation can't, they can't arise as long as Trump is there, right? As long as he's overshadowing, and he's going to hang in there, and he may run in 2024, and even if he doesn't, they can't really emerge. And so they're stuck where they were.
Well, Rubio is saying, I think accurately, that the Republican Party is becoming more of a working class party. You know, this rankles a lot of Democrats' ears because it's not that they have a lot of great working class policies, but they have more cultural affinity to a lot of working class voters. And that has paid off to some limited respect. What I think is hard for a Rubio type of candidate, as well as some of the others in this vein, like Hawley, it's not evident that having certain new kinds of policy ideas, you know, Josh Hawley going after big tech or Rubio with his versions of earning income tax credits, that is the secret sauce to maximizing, furthering their working class support. The Trump approach of bluster and divisiveness, confrontation, you know, dismissal of the experts, you know, these are the things that seem to be building those bonds.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, Bill, that's the thing, right? Is like, is there something unique about Trump that that made working class Americans, you know, attracted to him? Or can you, through policies and temperament, I mean, I guess one question would be, does it have to be Trump? Like, if Republicans had their Joe Biden or their Joe Manchin, could that person, sort of just a regular good old boy, lunch, you know, lunch pail, Joe six pack type guy, like, could that guy do it too? Does it have to be Trump? Does he have to be as mean and nasty and vulgar as Trump?
Well, the guy whose stock I think is rising very rapidly right now is Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. 6'8", former mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania, hardscrabble Pennsylvania town, tattoos, and has a big personality. And, you know, the question for him, is he going to run for senator or governor in 2022? Because both those seats, I think, are going to be open. I mean, we know Toomey's not running again. That'll be an open seat for Senate. I can't remember if Governor Wolf is term limited or not. But I believe the expectation is that he's not running for a third term. Correct me if I'm wrong about that. But, you know, I do think that Kamala Harris will have the inside track for any, whether it's 2024 or 2028, when the presidency opens up for on the Democratic side, VPs have the inside track in general. But man, assuming Fetterman continues to rise and is in a governor or senator's slot and nothing bad has come out about him, I should also add, his wife is a former undocumented immigrant. And they're both very active on social media and they have this kind of teasing relationship. Like, Fetterman just checks a lot of boxes. And to have a Harris-Fetterman 1-2 punch on paper is very akin to the Biden-Harris 1-2 punch. I do think Democrats need some of that. They need some of that, alpha,
yeah,
working class
once
energy.
Once Biden's gone, there's really nobody left, right? Like, there's not, like, who screams like Scranton after?
I mean, Conor Lamb is still there.
Conor Lamb, though, even though he's a veteran and he's obviously from, you know, Pennsylvania, he seems a little too polished, doesn't he? Doesn't he seem like he might be an elite?
Well, that's why I think Fetterman, my stock is higher in Fetterman than Lamb, but at least Lamb has the experience of running in these districts and winning. And you also have this class of national security women House members that the Democrats have, you know, Democrats lost some seats. But they kept most of their gains from 2018. This whole notion that Democrats totally botched it on the House races, I think is ignoring that it's very typical to give back some seats after a big double digit gain. You know, you win 41, you give back 10 or so. That's a fairly normal pattern. If you look back at the past patterns, I mean, maybe 10 is like a little bit more than is typical, but it's not wholly out of the realm of the back and forth. And so you still have Alyssa Slotkin, you still have Mickey Sherrill, you still have Abigail Spamberger. These are folks that potentially have, it's a different kind of appeal than a John Fetterman, but I don't think it is wholly irrelevant to the conversation of what Democrats need to maintain that big tent and make inroads and continue to make inroads in, you know, non-college educated, non-white constituencies.
So it seems like I need to go watch the latest Shareable before I file this piece.
Yeah, you know, up to you.
How's Shareable coming?
Shareable's going very well. We got over 500 subscribers. We're racking up our watch hours to the point of where it becomes monetizable. So, but we need more subscribers. So you got to clear 1,000 before I can start making some money off the thing. So if you want to see me make a living, by all means, subscribe to YouTube, subscribe to my channel. And I'll keep churning them out.
How do you decide what topics you're going to do?
You know, basically, I haven't been doing as much writing past few weeks. There's so many takes out there that's hard to do something on a freelance basis that's going to be unique and fresh by the time everyone else has a take on a particular election-related subject. So most of my time these days has been polishing my podcast, my history podcast, which I'm very close to finishing on. And if I have a fresh idea that might have otherwise been a column, you know, I'm just gonna put that together on YouTube and flesh it out in that space. So that's what I'm doing. And I think going forward, when I start getting back to more column writing, it's a question of what makes sense in video form that might not have quite the same, you know, hot take magic that a column needs to have for an editor to accept the pitch.
Yeah. Well, I'm watching them. Keep them coming. You're doing, what are you turning out, 2 or 3 a week, right?
That's the plan. That's the pace you need to keep in this YouTube environment.
I know. It seems like, so I have a YouTube also. I just put up, for now, I'm mainly just putting up my podcasts. So it's not like original content for YouTube. But I do notice, like, the more I put up, the more subscribers I get. And there must be something with the algorithm, like the more frequency you're posting stuff, the more people they're showing it to or something.
I think folks like the routine. They want to know you're putting stuff out there. Yeah. Why subscribe if you're going to be putting out stuff, you know, once every 2 months?
Well, yeah, but it, you know, in the email newsletter world, there's a different thing, which is the more you send an email newsletter, I mean, they do get shared and get subscribers, but sometimes you also lose people. The more, you know, because people are like, why is this guy emailing me? You know, even though they signed up for it. But I feel like with YouTube, because of the algorithm and stuff, anyway, I'm just speculating here. Who knows the witchcraft behind the way these things work? But anyway, sign up for Shareable.
And we're gonna DM Zoom tomorrow?
I think we should. I think we have to. We need to settle on a time.
But so if you're not already on our Patreon subscriber list, please do so you can get it on the DM Zooms.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk offline too. Like last week we had a special guest who came on and briefed us, and maybe you know, we'll see how things go, but maybe now that we're past the election, we could start bringing in some more guests to talk to the audience.
Absolutely.
So, awesome, man. Anything else before we wrap?
I think we're good.
All right. Well, hang in there, everybody. The Republic will survive. And we'll
be
back.
You're happy, right, Matt? You're happy things turned out the way they did.
I feel like the best, it's plausible that like the best possible scenario for someone like me is Republicans keep the Senate, which I think they probably will. Biden becomes president. We already got Amy Coney Barrett. They're not going to stack, you know, Biden can't pack the courts. And so it's not a horrible outcome for me. And you could argue if you're a sort of a center right, never Trumper, this was the best. I mean, the one bad thing is, you know, if Trump had been really defeated, like in a landslide, you would have had a better chance to actually get rid of Trump and Trumpism, to just purge and discredit Trumpism. And then the Republican Party and the conservative movement could begin to heal. But if that happened, Republicans probably wouldn't have retained the Senate, in which case I think the left would have been more emboldened. So, you know, you're never going to get the perfect scenario, but I think, yeah, it probably worked out maybe as good as it could have.
All right, we'll leave it there. I'll talk to you tomorrow on the DM Zoom and next week here on the DMZ.
All right. See you, everybody.